Honduras right now, it is also a battle for the future of Central America, which is the epicenter of extractive industries. So on the one hand, you have multinational corporations that are in Honduras to take over forests, mines, waters, indigenous lands, and intellectual property rights, which others call indigenous knowledge. And on the other hand, you have social movements, which in Central America have been led by Gustavo Castro and by Berta Cáceres for the protection of these indigenous lands, for rights, and for participatory democracy.
Because this is International Women's Day, I want to end with the words of Berta Cáceres when she won the 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize.
Our Mother Earth, militarized, fenced in, poisoned, a place where basic rights are systematically violated, demands that we take action.
Again, that was the assassinated Honduran indigenous environmentalist, Berta Cáceres. And I also will continue to cover what is happening to Gustavo Castro Soto. Though the Mexican ambassador tried to get him out of Honduras, he survived the assassination attempt on him, but he's been shot twice. The Honduran authorities are continuing to keep him. Bev Bell, thanks so much for joining us from New Mexico. And that does it for our broadcast. To see our full report on Berta Cáceres, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Has 3 job openings. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now!
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland 90.7. The time is 5 o'clock. And so coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Roland will talk with Beverly Bell on the assassination last week of Honduran indigenous and environmental activist Berta Cáceres, winner of the 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize. Bell is with the group Other Worlds, which has collaborated closely with the group Cáceres founded, the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. And at 9 on Political Perspectives, experts express alarm at sudden warming in the Arctic, from the series Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passinart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. Smoldering Fires explores how to apply the ideas and struggles of the civil rights movement to contemporary city life through the point of view of 2 young friends who differ in temperament and approach. Again, that's Smoldering Fires, March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 Northeast Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Lady Aoi, produced by Imago Theater. The play runs from March 11th through the 27th at the Imago Theater in Portland. Set in a hospital in 1956, The Lady Aoi is an erotic ghost story written by Yukio Mashima based on a 15th century no play. Again, that's The Lady Aoi, March 11th through March 27th at the Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Why does women's history matter? It seems like a simple answer. Because we're here, we've contributed, because we're human. But there's more. Max Dashew has dedicated her life's work to recovering the truth about women's and indigenous histories, truths that have been omitted and erased from history books. Without that history, we don't know how we came to be in this colonialist patriarchal system, and we don't know that there's potential for something different. March is Women's History Month in the United States, and March 8th is International Women's Day. As such, I spoke with Max, an artist, educator, and the founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, about the importance of women's history and about her work. Here's that interview. To start, I wonder if you can just talk about how you first got interested in women's history and how you got involved in doing your work.
I was of the age before there was women's studies. So I was in college, and women's history was literally a joke. And I was taking classes, you know, anthropology classes, and they're saying, well, you know, there are these matrilineal societies, but that doesn't mean anything. You know, men have always dominated in all human societies. And I'm just going, matrilineal societies? And so, you know, I began to pursue that. It was also the Vietnam War era, and I wound up just saying, okay, you know, what am I doing in this ruling class college? Let me get out of here and give up the scholarship and go out and just do this on my own. Because I just really felt like it was important to have some other, basically now you would call it decolonizing knowledge, you know, but just to dig through the cultural record and see what was out there. Are there any places where women have been free? Because I could see that the society I grew up in was not like that at all. And so I just began doing this research on my own, and I was reading everything that I could lay my hands on, which in 1969, 1970, there weren't that many books on women anything. You know, you go to the card catalog and it would be housewives, women, housewives, wives, marriage, you know, stuff like that. Beauty, fashion, cooking. And so, you know, that was, I began to really look into what I thought might be societies where there was a chance that women had a better deal. And so I started looking at Aboriginal societies, and in order to do that, I also had to know where the empires were, so it was really kind of an exhaustive survey that, you know, has taken decades to really get my head around what all is out there. And in the process, I discovered that libraries organize information in very patriarchal and colonial ways. It's very linear, it's very rigid, and it's all divided. So the information I wanted was all chopped up, little pieces here under technology for weaving, little pieces over there, big pieces in anthropology. And when you're looking for indigenous history, you're finding it more listed under ethnography. You're not finding it on the history shelves. That's changed to some extent, but that's, you know, that was a pattern, and that continues to be a pattern. Mm-hmm. And so it was all about how all of these chunks that I was finding could be woven back together.
You know, so why has women's history and indigenous history been erased from, you know, recorded history, history books, the history mm-hmm. section? Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
There are multiple causes for that. Number one, elite men are writers of history, and they're done primarily for dynastic or, you know, political power reasons. And so that's a big part of it. But it's also about the gatekeepers of knowledge and their hostility or their disinterest or their ideological distortion of the information they had and how much of that gets through. I can't tell you how many times I've read an account about a particular society and there was nothing about an important female sphere of power or a very crucial female figure. And then later on I'd get a little piece. And even that little piece would not contain the whole story. And so you'd have to just keep looking and looking, and eventually it would emerge. A really good example of that was I was looking at Central Asia. And in the Turkic and Mongolian societies, there are very strong traditions of female shamans. And so that's a significant female sphere of power, even though we're looking at patrilineal societies. And so I thought, wow, I'm going to get my hands. There was something called The Secret History of the Mongols. And I said, I got to read that because I know that's going to have some stuff in it. Look at that title. There was nothing. There was absolutely zero. Decades roll by, and then Jack Weatherford comes out with a book called The Secret History of the Mongol Queens. And he actually documents how these portions, there were really important political roles played by Mongolian women. but they were deliberately excised after the time of Genghis Khan, whose daughters were really major figures, and were taken out by the Mongolian elite men. And so you have all these kinds of silences and censorships and omissions and just really torquing interpretation of what we're looking at, which can really throw things off, too. For example, you know, calling the female icons of ancient times fertility idols or dancing girls or concubines. You know, there's all kinds of assumptions packed into these kinds of labels. And for the most part, people tend to receive those. You know, they're all around us, like the sea that we're swimming in. They receive those labels as reflective of reality when they really are much more ideological and political.
And, you know, this is probably obvious to us, but perhaps not to everyone, but why is it important that we recover these histories?
For a variety of reasons. I mean, the dynastic historians understood how important the historical record is to leverage agendas. And I think that, you know, when I was growing up, certainly the way we were taught about women really inculcates values and behaviors and all kinds of actual social institutions that people tend to take for granted. They become unconscious background. And it's very demoralizing for women and girls, you know, to have this absence of ourselves, anything that reflects who we are. And we see these very restrained and narrow and tight versions of femininity. They're being shot at us. We've got the mass media doing that to a degree even worse than anything before. And so they're measuring themselves against that, and they're feeling strange or weird if that doesn't correspond to how they feel, who they are, what their reality is. So if you have a history that says, well, wait a minute, you know, there were these really powerful women who led revolts against colonial rule, that makes things look very different. It's not all male warriors all of a sudden. You can start to see the really courageous part that women often have played in standing up against conquest or, you know, in resisting patriarchy. The female rebels and mavericks who were reviled many times in their own societies, but some of them managed to get over the top and actually succeed in whatever it was, you know, whatever they were doing. And so if we don't have that information, it circumscribes our view of what's possible for us. And it also underlays a whole political narrative about who humans are, who women are, what society is like, has to be like, has always been like. And if you believe that society has always been based on domination, and whether that's patriarchy or, you know, Anglo conquest or settler society or whatever, the, you know, class systems, those are all interlocking. That's a whole other subject. But, you know, if you're given this description of reality that makes that seem inevitable, how exactly are you going to fight against it? You know, you become demoralized and you're just feeling like you're dragging the stone up the mountain without allies, without a sense of some kind of collective female or human solidarity that is based in a shared past. And this is why all liberation movements, I don't care if you're talking about the Rastafarians or who you're talking about, need the Garveyites, need a history that shows them something about their reality, not the reality that's been imposed on them, you know, the slaveholders or, you know, the churchmen who are like, well, you know, females are by the order of nature subordinated to males. You know, they give us all of these very intense teachings is the wrong word, but doctrines, I guess, dogmas, that train us into feeling like there's nothing that can be done. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing about history is you can learn from it. You know, you can learn from how those things are carried out. You can learn about how divide and conquer works. And I think as women, it's really important for us to understand things like the witch hunts and the ways that women have been trained to collude and collaborate with male domination. the structures of male domination, to enforce them, to socialize daughters into them. And sometimes this is done because mothers are, they know, they're afraid of the female punishments that are doled out for not conforming, you know. So it's very complex, all of this. Mm-hmm. But that's, we have to be able to start to get our minds around all of that complexity and the interrelationship of oppression. In 1970, when I was starting, there was just this very polarized view of women's liberation versus all the various national or ethnic liberation struggles, or even the class struggle. You know, lots of shooting back and forth. You know, is it going to be women or is it going to be blacks? Is it going to be class or is it going to be the bourgeois feminists? All these framings at that time. Or spiritual versus political, something that's really, we've made a lot of progress on that because people are starting to see how resistance can be integrated with the spiritual, as in Idle No More, you know, as in a lot of things that, you know, demonstrations where people are drumming and singing and carrying masks. So it's useful for us to know that background and also to understand some of these interrelationships and to have that awareness as a way that we can then fight back against people who are saying, oh, we only have to look at this one thing, or, you know, that issue's not important, without seeing, in the case of women's oppression, how deeply it underlies capitalism, empire, all of these things.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the witch hunts, and I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit. You know, how does how did they play into, you know, female subordination, male domination, and, you know, what's the actual history of witch hunts? I take it that they've been recorded and interpreted in history books inaccurately.
Inaccurately and to a large extent omitted. You know, there's really very little in most general histories that go into this in any depth whatsoever. And then a lot of the books about it also, again, you've got these ideological templates. You've got respected historians saying, well, you know, the witch hunts weren't gendered. Hello! Or saying things like, well, they were just senile old women who were saying things that they believed about the devil without acknowledging that they were tortured. You know, we're talking about torture trials. And so these women were actually, in a very political use of culture, being forced to parrot back pornographic demonologies. You know, painful sex with devils, rape by devils. Yeah. The whole theme of black devils gets sewed in there as well. And so there's another interrelationship. But witch hunts, we have several different strands going on. One is straight up subordination of females. It's a policing and a terror campaign against women. Obey and conform or else, you know, and anyone who didn't, who was loud, who talked back to her husband, who went out in the forest and was partying with her girls out there drinking beer in Scotland, could be denounced, oh, what were they doing out there in the woods, you know? And so you have this very repressive culture-wide smackdown of women. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is there are all these themes out of the old pagan cultures of Europe that come through in the witch hunt trial transcripts. And so then you've got all these themes of woman as priestess, as healer, as diviner. And there were actually women caught up in the hunts that answered to those roles. They were not the majority at the period of the mass hunts. And that point has been made many times. But in fact, there were cases where women were engaged in divination. A lot of the Italian scholars especially have documented cases of healers and even counselors who were dealing with battered women or deserted women who wanted remedies, you know, for their political situation. And so there's a lot of that aspect to it. And this goes to what I would call the internal colonization of Europe. I think we cannot underestimate the degree to which European culture was transformed by Romanization, by Christianization, and then this gradual buildup of a repression of folk religion and especially women's role inside of that and the larger project of just smacking women down and making the society more male-dominated. And all of those things, all those strands figure in. And you've got different takes on that, you know, different flavors of the repression depending on the region you're looking at and its particular history. But it comes to the point of what I call the terror, you know, the burning times. And patterns of persecution. So you've got women, you've got elders, old women especially as a target, the poor, common folk, gays or trans or whoever, you know, lesbians, wise women, and then all of this, not just the burnings, but searching for witch marks, which were basically rapes, you know, of being stripped and manhandled by dungeon masters or witch hunters and poked in their privates looking for witches, devil's marks or, you know, tags on their bodies. And you have witches' bridles, and this really speaks to the silencing. You know, they're also called scolds' bridles or the branks. And so there, at the time that the burnings were going on in Europe, you also have other kinds of ritual humiliations of women where they would be, their hands would be immobilized and they'd be marched through the streets of Germany with animal masks, with horns or asses' ears. They would be thrown into ducking chairs and immersed into canals that were full of sewage and half-drowned or maybe sometimes actually drowned. There's just this whole massive onslaught of repression that was brought to bear, especially after the Middle Ages, but beginning in the Middle Ages, of and fines and physical attacks with knives. It was believed in Britain that if you scored a witch, if you drew blood, it would break her spell over you. And so you had men going after women, slashing their faces. Mm. And you have lynchings and exiles and women not able to live in the village anymore and becoming homeless. And all of these different things, it's not just burning at the stake. And so all of this, the important thing about this as a bridge issue is that not only is this patriarchal, but there is a way in which the witch hunts and the torture trials and the burnings forged an ideology of domination around this whole concept, demonology, of the idea that other religions are devil worship, devil worshippers, and this became a template for colonization in the Americas and the Philippines and Africa and all these other places. So it all ties together. There's even a case of a Basque bishop who, I guess he was a witch hunter in the Basque country of Spain, Zumarraga, and he burns women at the stake as witches in Spain. And then he goes to Mexico and becomes appointed as the bishop of Mexico City. And there he's burning at the stake Aztecs for devil worship. So there are even direct connections like that. And you could probably count the Salem witch hunts in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very deep history of interrelated oppressions. And also there is, under all of this, there is a commonality in that folk religion with Europe to the rest of the world, something that gets lost sight of a lot because they, in fact, did have drums. And they even had sweat lodges, the Tachan Alish of the Irish, the Bojina of the Russians, the Sauna of the Finns. And so, and these were places of ritual. Redrawing those connections, I think, is really important. Because when we look at the issues, the New Age cultural appropriations that go on, if we don't have our own, those of us who are of European descent, if we don't have our own authentic place to stand, then there will be appropriation. You have to have some sense of your own roots. And, you know, to find something positive in those roots, not only the very important responsibility we have to face up to the terrible wrongs of the settler conquest.
You wrote about how valuable the overlooked testimony of indigenous oral tradition is, and how, in your words, such an investigation also takes in how codes of domination and subordination become embedded into culture. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how, you know, the suppression of women's history connects to the suppression of indigenous oral histories and the impact of that.
Well, you know, the suppression of indigenous oral histories is in itself a suppression of women's histories right there. I mean, not only women's histories, but that is one of the richest sources that I've seen, you know, in reading all these books and looking for stories about women who were important movers and shakers, or even just patterns of entire collectivities within cultures, you know, of the builders and the clan mothers and all the biochemical technologies invented by women. I mean, there's some of this you don't necessarily have individual names. It's more about what groups of women do and the degree of economic importance or even centrality they have in Aboriginal cultures. So that's a whole part of it. And, you know, in being able to track back those Aboriginal orature is a word that's come up a lot. You know, there's literature, and so then there's orature is the oral tradition or the oral history. And, you know, it's not done the way that European history is done, you know, in academia especially. But it's something that carries testimony about past and ancestors and foundations and meanings. And so it's really full of amazing stories about women who were, for example, if you go into Zimbabwe, the Goba people have oral histories about a priestess or a shaman really named Kasamba, of the who founded a sanctuary at Njami Hill. And so she was like this foundational figure, and there's numbers of these in Zimbabwe and Shona tradition of oracular women who found sanctuaries. And so it's very much tied to the land, you know, as the Australian Aboriginals would say, you know, it's coming out of country and relationship to country. And so she not only founds this as a spiritual and as a cultural institution, but it also becomes an important political force. And so for male chiefs to get approval from these priestesses for their authority, you know, there's all this jockeying back and forth, and you even have an episode where a conqueror takes over the shrine and boots out the priestesses, and it, after a while he goes down in flames and the whole thing kind of reconfigures itself and reconstitutes itself, and so you have a continuity that was not so easy to defeat. I think a lot of us in trying to theorize about this, I know I did at the early days, it seemed like, well, once patriarchy took over, you know, it seemed like it was one process that happened and then it was done. And then, boom, you were patriarchal. But there's a lot more back and forth and a lot more resistance and a lot more resilience than that idea holds out to us. That's an example of the kind of information you can get out of the Indigenous histories. And there are a lot of others that just go, we could go on about that. But I think that women's history has to be reconceived in a decolonizing way, because, you know, a lot of people think about women's history as Queen Elizabeth I, oh, powerful women, rah-rah, Susan B. Anthony, and they don't really understand all. I mean, we have to have like this multi-level understanding, because Queen Elizabeth did a lot of bad things for women. I mean, she heard some laws passed in her reign helped accelerate the witch hunts in Britain, and of course she was also a major colonial figure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's been this tendency of looking for great women, and that's why I like to emphasize the collective aspect of it. And also, the other thing about the Indigenous orature is that sometimes it also tells us about the onset of patriarchy. You know, the intrusion of male control over spheres that were previously founded by women. And you'll find examples of that in, say, Aztec history, where you've got the Cihuacuatl, meaning the serpent woman. This is a title of a political office. It was also the name of a goddess and a creator figure. And so this becomes a male office. The name tells us that it's a female sphere, but it's taken over by men. And we can track this in the Congo, where you've got in the Lunda tradition, there are titles, first female pillar, first courageous woman, and those two got taken over by males. So the Aboriginal tradition, I mean, you know, many Indigenous societies are not egalitarian in terms of sex and gender. And so you need to look at those testimonies, and especially these stories of male takeover, for clues about what's going on there. And I would say also for the importance of religious and cultural institutions in, you know, when those are seized and women lose that, they lose the masks, they lose the ritual trumpets or whatever it is that's at issue, the medicine bags, then you see a shrinkage of female authority, you know, and there are records of this. They're not the same as having an inscription and someone can say, oh, you know, King Esarhaddon, and you know, had this written on stone in the year 1200 BCE or whatever. It's not going to be in that form, but it is a culture's own assessment of a change that happened where women's authority got sliced into.
Mm-hmm. You say that the investigation of women's history has become passé. Where have you seen this happen, or where have you seen this said, and why do you think that this is or isn't the case, I suppose?
Sadly, I've seen this happen in women's studies itself. You know, there's been a really big move away from women's history. A lot of it is really about sociology of the present, mass studies of mass media, gender performativity, gender theory, lots of high theory. And there is just, like, you know, Women's History Month used to be a time, I mean, that the name itself says it, but it becomes shifted over into things that really aren't about women's history, and the course offerings in women's history have gone down. You know, the consideration of the past and what it might have to offer us, even in terms of forming theory, there's just been this huge move away from it. And, of course, the move to gender studies even takes us off of concentrating on looking at women and looking at oppression by sex. So there are all these trends going on. And so I just see that something, you know, on the other hand, there are more books being published that relate to women's history than ever before. So it's not all bad. But I just, as someone who lectured in universities for decades, I just watched the sphere of interest for this inside gender studies kind of just wash away. And that's been frustrating to me because, I just really don't think we've even begun to scratch the surface of reconstructing the whole story of human experience with women integrated. Put women at the center. See what the world looks like then.
And finally, can you tell me about the Suppressed History Archives and about your crowdfunder?
Yeah, well, the Suppressed Histories Archives turned 44 in January. And so what I've started to do is to digitize the slide collection. There's about 15,000 slides. I'm not exactly sure yet how many images there are. And then I have tens of thousands more digital images already. And so I'm doing a two-pronged thing this year, which is to digitize the slide collection and format and label and a lot of other things, archive, but also then to pour this digital content along with essays and videos and articles onto the Suppressed Histories website. And on there, you can see that we're doing a fundraiser to try and finance these expansions. We're going to need a bunch of technical help to do some of the things, getting the videos online, for example, and certainly the gargantuan task of the scanning and formatting. But really, my plan is to just get this all as open source as much as possible. And so, you know, really just organize it in a way that will be hyperlinked between regions and ethnicities and time periods to various subjects like medicine women or female leaders or patriarchy or goddess veneration. I mean, it's just countless categories. So, you know, just to make it more accessible and have that information available. So I'm hoping people will look at that. If you go to the Suppressed Histories website, yeah, the upper left of the page there, you can see our Indiegogo campaign. And spread the word about it, and hopefully people will want to donate, because this kind of women's history does not get funded by foundations. And me, without degrees, I don't get funded either. So it's really a grassroots undertaking, and it's very political.
You just heard an interview with Max Dashew, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives. For more on her work and to contribute to her Indiegogo campaign, visit suppressedhistories.net. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.
The Rabble Podcast Network Show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On Saturday, December 5th, Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter hosted their annual Montreal Massacre Memorial event at the Vancouver Public Library. The event happens in congruence with the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women on December 6th, the anniversary of the murders of 14 women at L'École Polytechnique de Montréal in 1989. Also known as the Montreal Massacre. The following panel, moderated by Samantha Gray, was titled Creating Alternative Platforms for Feminist Analysis and includes a discussion of the kind of no-platforming and silencing of feminists that has become commonplace in recent years, as well as addresses the way in which some of us have been able to continue speaking out against male violence and oppression in the face of attacks. Lear Keith is the first speaker, I am the second. Lear Keith is a writer, small farmer, and radical feminist activist. She is the author of 6 books, including The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. She is also co-author with Derek Jensen and Arik McBay of Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. She's been arrested 6 times for acts of political resistance.
Okay, so a brief history of how we got here. 10,000 years ago, we're going to go fast. Patriarchy in various versions starts popping up around the globe, and bit by bit, it of course conquers the world. That's what patriarchy does. The only good thing to say about this is that wherever there is oppression, you will find resistance. There is some portion of us as a human collective that always refuses to submit. So one such resistance is, of course, the second wave of feminism. 1970 marks the publication of the book Sisterhood is Powerful, and at that point, the movement is well and truly launched. Women win and continue to win crucial victories. Legal abortion, rape shield laws, domestic violence shelters, the Nordic model. But just like there's always resistance, there is always backlash, and there are always collaborators. And what you hope is that the resistance is strong enough that the collaborators don't break your hearts completely. So in 1982, Ellen Willis invents this term, quote, sex-positive feminism, to distinguish herself from radical feminism. To this day, I cannot fathom what is positive about rape, torture, and slavery with a dose of capitalism thrown in for good measure. If you think that's hyperbole, I don't have slides today, but I urge you to go to Google and type in these 4 letters, P-O-R-N, right? Done to any other group of people, this would be recognized as a human rights horror. Done to women, it's good, clean, positive fun. All right. 1991, Rebecca Walker coins the term third wave feminism to describe this approach to women's oppression. It's kind of like feminism, except without the pesky feminism. One definition of third wave feminism, and this is their words, not mine, whether you decide as a woman to make your own aesthetic decisions and choices. Now, no man is told that his hopes and dreams, his moral agency, and indeed his humanity depends on what shoes he wears. And no oppressed man has ever been told that his liberation is about what he decides to wear. But even if we drop that word aesthetic, we're still left with a serious problem, that the best we can do is make the best choices we can. That's not liberation, that's capitulation. Now, in the words of Andrea Dworkin, feminism is the political practice of fighting male supremacy on behalf of women as a class. It really is just that simple. There's a group of people who are systematically hurt. You fight to change the material conditions, not to make the best choice you can for yourself, to change those conditions. Dworkin named women's condition as the barricade of sexual terrorism. Rape, incest, battering, prostitution, pornography. Women are the people inside that barricade. Men are outside. In fact, men are...
We have been experiencing some technical difficulties, so we're going to listen to some Alice Coltrane. Enjoy.
May there be peace and love and perfection throughout all creation. O God, may there be peace and love and perfection throughout all creation. O God, may there be peace and love and perfection throughout all creation. O God.
Thank you. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven in Portland. Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, is a brand new variety show style monthly night, taking cues from vaudevillian traditions and narrative comedy. Each month's showcase features a different lineup of performers, bringing together a wide range of artistic disciplines and focusing on polished short pieces from our thriving clown, circus, vaudevillian, and alternative performance communities right here in Portland. Again, that's Oddville, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, 1464 Southeast 2nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Retta Christie, and with some special programming for International Women's Day, I'm here for the next hour and a half with I Wanna Be a Cowboy Sweetheart. It's the women of country and western music. We're going to start right off with some Patsy Montana.